the voices of working people. To learn more, contact Volunteer Coordinator Adrian Rainey at 608-321-9583 or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out an application. Labor Radio, a voice for workers.
Welcome to the Access Hour, where each week WORT offers you the opportunity to fly your program over the radio. The Access Hour is WORT's commitment to community access to the airwaves. For this hour, we have turned the airwaves over to a member of the public. The views expressed on the Access Hour do not represent the views of the station, its staff, programmers, or the board of directors. We'd like this show to be as unpredictable as possible, so we need your creative ideas. It's a fair trade. You give us what you've got, and we give you the facilities and any help you need to get your program airborne. So let your mind wander and wonder. And when the inspiration for some pretty good radio glows with a clear, bright light, get in touch. Just go to WORTFM.org and look on the left side for Sign Up to Host an Access Hour. Programs are scheduled first come, first served. And now it's time to begin another foray into the freest form program on the WORT schedule, the Access Hour.
Hello, welcome to the Access Hour. My name is Vicki Kenyon, and I'm going to be your host tonight. I'm a realtor with Stark Company Realtors. I've always loved connecting with people and connecting people to resources. So when I started my second career as a realtor, I found that much of the queer and trans community on a national level is not connecting to home ownership at the same rate as everyone else. So nationally, about 65% of Americans own homes, and only 49% of those in the queer and trans community own homes. That's a 16% swing, very significant. About 50% of queer and trans renters are afraid of discrimination in the home buying process, and this is keeping people in our community away from pursuing home ownership at all. So it's not surprising that gender expansive folks are the most fearful by a long shot. Okay, so here's the good news. My team of friends and I are here tonight, and we're going to have some conversation about home ownership. I'm going to have everybody introduce themselves. Why don't you start?
Yes, I am Heidi Andrew. I am with Epic Mortgage. It is a brokerage out of Brookfield, but I am here in the Madison area.
Hi, I'm Sam Considine with Haven Home Inspections, and I'm in the South Central Wisconsin area, and I'm excited to be here.
And I'm Adam Erdman with Renovation Sells Madison, a home improvement company.
And I'm Bex Laird with Goosehead Insurance Laird Agency.
Thanks, friends, for being here. So I think that most of us will agree that one of the first two people you should talk with in the home buying process are a realtor and a lender, in one of those two orders. Heidi, tell us a little bit about why getting pre-qualified is so important in the process, especially in a competitive market.
Yes, so it's actually a pre-approval. There's in the lending market, there's a difference between a pre-approval and a pre-qualification. So you want to actually shoot for getting a pre-approval. Most realtors will actually not start shopping for you or showing homes until you have a pre-approval letter or you can show that you have the funds to purchase. And the other reason is you don't want to be out shopping, fall in love with a home, and then go and get pre-approved and then realize you cannot afford it.
Right. That would be sad.
It is really sad.
Yeah. So pre-approval is key. Also, then when you see a home that you really like, we can write an offer quickly and be effective.
That is one of my favorite parts about having the pre-approval ahead of time is that when you want to go through and write the offer and put it in, you can do it very quickly.
Right, right. So, Bex, I want to talk about insurance for a second. We all know that homeowners need homeowner insurance. But tell us why you think having renter's insurance is just as important, if not even more so.
Well, when you know you're going to be shopping for a home of your own in the future, say 6 months to a year prior, it's really good to have a history of having insurance. And that history goes into making your future home or condo premium. So if you have a history of insurance and it's going well, you don't have claims, you're paying on time, that creates a better score for you so that your new home or your new condo, the insurance for that is actually going to be less.
Kind of like a credit score, huh?
Yeah. It's not a hard hit to your credit when we do a quote for you, but it does create a financial score that they use to determine in part what your premium will be. So yeah, any insurance that you have ahead of time, including, you know, good liability limits on your auto, all of that goes into making your personal financial score for insurance.
So at what point in the home buying process should we start talking with someone about homeowners insurance?
Pretty soon after the accepted offer. When you're talking about the home buying process and they've already talked to Heidi and they've already talked to you, right when you get that accepted offer, it's necessary to start looking at home quotes once they have that address.
I've been hearing some conversation amongst colleagues about changes in the insurance industry that are making it harder to get insured. For example, the age of roofs and things like that. Can you just talk for a minute about how that insurance world is changing?
Yeah, it's changed in the last year or two. All of your insurance agents, if you know any, give them a hug or whatever. Maybe don't. Maybe they need a little bit of distance from humanity because we've all been working so many long hours trying to find new insurance for people or finding how to lower some of the premiums. But premiums have been skyrocketing. Sometimes it's not for anything most of the time it isn't actually for anything anyone has done. I've had a couple of conversations already today, and I've had probably hundreds this year already about how my premiums are going up and I haven't done anything. I haven't had any accidents. I haven't had any claims on my home. I haven't had any tickets. Why is this happening to me? Why am I being punished for other people's bad deeds? And it's not necessarily the case. Insurance is oddly very communal. So what everybody does affect premiums for everybody else. The world is round. And so the fires on the other side of the U.S. affect premiums in Wisconsin and everywhere else. But we've had some stuff aside from climate change and disaster. We've had just people kind of being a little bit weird after the pandemic. We've been getting in more accidents, and also the cars that we drive are much harder and more expensive to fix. So if you think about what a old fender bender used to be like when a fender was just a fender, now a fender is not a fender. It's a camera and it's got sensors and it's got all this stuff. And so what it might have been like $400 to fix is now, you know, $2,500 to fix. And so if you add that up over millions of people who need auto insurance, you've got companies that have been really hurting, and that's what they're doing. They're increasing premiums in order to get them back into solvency. We need insurance, you know, to kind of maintain civilization, whether you like it or hate it. Most of us on the consumer side kind of dislike it. I understand that.
You're a consumer too.
I'm a consumer too. And so, you know, but it is the way it is. Yeah, you're going to see premiums go up regardless of your behavior or your claims. And when people do call in and they haven't had anything, but their premiums have gone up, I'm giving like a little sigh of relief, because the sad cases are when people didn't maybe know how to structure their insurance beforehand and had maybe three claims this year. Well, now they're being canceled by their current carrier. And once that gets into a cancellation process, it can be really hard to find them stuff. Right. So those are the people that I feel for.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, Heidi, another question back to you for a second. You work for a lending broker. Bex is with an insurance broker, which is a little different than a standard lender or a standard insurance provider. Can you just give us a brief idea of what that variance is?
So the variance is that I, that work at a brokerage, have access to many lenders and their many products, whereas someone who maybe works for a retail lender or who works for a bank, they work for that one lender and just have their products. So I have access to many lenders, which means I have many more products that I can offer. And sometimes it can be a little overwhelming because people are bringing on new products all the time. And so you're trying to make sure that you get educated on how they work and how that is going to affect your home buyers and your homeowners.
Perfect. Yep. Good stuff. So, Sam, let's talk about inspections for a minute. Tell us when you think a good time for an inspection would be.
Yeah, absolutely. The typical time, the most of the time that people need an inspection is when they have an accepted offer to buy a home. And I used to ask on the phone when people called me, oh, yeah, when are you hoping to get this done? And I stopped asking because everybody said, as soon as possible, because the market has changed and things move quickly in real estate now. So if you have an accepted offer on a home or you think you might be putting in an offer on a home, it'd be a good idea to start shopping around to find out what inspector you want to use. Asking realtor, asking friends if they've had a great experience. Always there's Google. But look into, typically you've got about a 10 or 15 day window. And you could be more of an expert on this than I with just how the market is, but usually it's 10 days now. When you've got that accepted offer, you've got 10 days to get a home inspection done, get the results back, and make decisions about what you want to do moving forward.
Right. That's about right. So what's the home inspection process like? Is the buyer there? Is the seller there? How do you usually work that?
I encourage buyers to be there every time if they can. I think there's so much. You certainly don't have to be, you know, if you're an out-of-state buyer or it just doesn't work. I think don't give up quickly on finding a home inspector that might be flexible to your schedule. But if for some reason you can't be there, reports are great. There will be pictures, there'll be descriptions. Certainly you can buy a home without being there. However, if you can be present, you get a whole education on what it is to maintain a home. I just did a home inspection today and I was talking through, hey, these exterior hose bibs are turned off, but here's where you turn them on. This is a maintenance issue you might want to think about. If you're there in person, there's a few things you might not get through a report that you'll be able to get and you'll be able to lay your eyes on it. Also, if there's a problem that comes up and you see it in a report, it can feel really overwhelming. But if you're there in person, it can be a back and forth conversation about, well, is this really a serious issue and what are some options moving forward? What could we potentially do about it?
Especially for a first-time homeowner where you've lived in an apartment and the landlord just fixes every little thing, right?
Or they don't, but yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's as basic as showing you where the air filters are that need to get changed and what size they are and that type of advice, right?
Yep, absolutely.
So this might be a little bit of a controversial question, but how do you feel about waiving an inspection contingency? And what that means is if I have an inspection contingency, I'm saying that I'm not going to purchase your home until we have an inspection, and then we'll see how it all plays out.
Yes. We live in a world of supply and demand.
Yeah.
So I have if you waived home inspection or if you've considered it because you're in a very demanding market, there is zero judgment for you. This is a safe space. It's risky. It's, everything about buying a home is how much risk can you handle, whether it's price, whether it's what you need to fix, whether it's even conversations once you've had a home inspection. And so if you have cash flow or cash on hand and you're willing to take the risk that, well, I didn't get this inspected and that might cost me a lot of money, well, maybe that's a risk you can take to be more competitive. Mm-hmm. I am seeing that in the market right now, home inspections are back in vogue. It's great. So people are really doing a lot of them.
That's good.
But I do think, a lot of people who didn't waive a home inspection probably won't feel that until they sell their home. They might be getting through things that it's like, okay, yeah, it's an issue, but it's not the end of the world. And then when they sell their home, if they do a home inspection, that can be a problematic time to not have done it.
Can I just jump in a
yes,
sec
please.
About what happens when you don't get a home inspection and then you get insurance?
Yes, tell us.
Okay, cool, thanks. I raised my hand, but I don't know if anybody saw it.
I got you.
But anyway. Okay, awesome. So what happened to me once was, when I'm doing an insurance quote and I ask the client all sorts of things about the house, I hope that they know them. And if they have an inspection report, they oftentimes know them a lot better than they would without it. And if I ask a client, particularly a first-time home buyer, maybe doesn't know much about houses, hey, what's the condition? How's the roof looking? I might only have like a Zillow picture to go on. So I'm really relying on what the client knows. And a lot of times what I had encountered maybe last year, not so much coming into this year, I think people are more knowledgeable, but last year, oh yeah, roof is great, no problem. Well, insurance companies all perform their own insurance inspections, and sometimes what their idea is great is not what the client's idea was of great. And they'll get they might get a cancellation because the roof is actually, fluffy, and it's not supposed to be
fluffy. Oh my goodness.
It's not supposed to look like a chicken ruffled its feathers. It's not supposed to, it's supposed to lay kind of flat. And those are things that I might not know, and I'm relying on the client to know, and the client only knows what they know unless they have an inspection. So I do hope that everyone out there gets inspections. That's all I'll say. Sorry for the interruption.
No, that's good info.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, getting a home inspection is such a safety, not only financially, but also from any sort of potential concerns in the future. It really limits your liability, both for the seller and the buyer, actually, because a seller is required to disclose what they know about a home. And if there's a home inspection done, well, then now a trained professional whose job is to inspect homes has now shared with all parties what the condition of the home is. And so if something comes up later, well, the inspector carries most of that liability over the seller. Now, if a seller deliberately chooses not to disclose something, they still hold liability. But if it's something they maybe didn't know about, well, if the home inspector missed it and nobody knew about it, it's going to come down more on the home inspector. So even the seller has this protection as far as liability goes when a home inspection occurs.
Sam, right before we started this conversation, you were telling us that you are doing some pre-listing inspections, probably more than you used to. Mm-hmm. And what's that process like? And how do you feel that's advantageous for someone who's trying to sell their home?
Yeah, pre-listing inspection would be the idea that the seller pays for a home inspection before they list the home. The beauty of it is it really clears their liability because now they've paid, like I said, a professional to give an assessment of the home, and they're sharing that condition with potential buyers. Also, it just makes the process so smooth. It's so rare that a pre-listing inspection happens that then the buyers request another home inspection. They can look at the home inspector's website. They can see what associations they're part of. They can sort of vet that home inspection to feel safe and trusting it most of the time. So the closing process, the home inspection is the biggest hiccup with the closing process in a lot of instances. And so now you as a seller, sure, you paid $400 or $500, whatever it costs to get this pre-listing inspection done. But now your liability is greatly decreased and your closing process is incredibly smoother because that buyer came to the table making an offer contingent on the fact that they already knew the conditions reported from the home inspection.
Yeah, that's awesome. I like the idea of that. It's not common. I wish it was more common.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially in a competitive market, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Adam, I'm getting ready to sell my home. And there's a few things that I need done around the house. Talk about what kinds of things people are doing to spruce up the home before they sell. What should we be looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. So every home, of course, is a little bit different in terms of what it needs. And when I walk into a house to look at it, I'm usually thinking about taking one of two approaches. The first one is the broad brush approach, right? And I'm going to be looking at primarily flooring and paint throughout the home. It's still pretty common that neutral colors are really top of mind for anybody who's looking at a house and just makes a house show better when it's all neutral. But then the other thing that I'm looking at too, of course, is kitchens and bathrooms, because those are the most expensive things to update and replace. And those are the things that homeowners are looking at or buyers are looking at most closely. And, is it going to suit their needs? So a lot of times it's looking at those two things and looking at the finishes that are trending today, what's popular. A lot of time, of course, you'll see, you'll hear sellers say, my neighbor got so and such and such amount for their house. I'm sure I can get that much for mine. Well, it all depends on the condition of the property and what those finishes are, because by having those more neutral finishes, you're going to be able to attract a broader pool of buyers. And then with that broader pool of buyers, that's how you can help drive up your price. That's how you can get more money when you go to sell.
So I'm getting ready to sell my house because I'm moving into a new house, right? And I had to pre-qualify and get pre-approved for my mortgage. So my mortgage is set. But now I realize I have to do some renovations. How do I afford renovations on a home without really screwing up the lending process that I already have set up?
Yeah, there are certainly lots of different ways that you can approach that. I mean, some people do have the resources. A lot of times we work with baby boomers in general, and so it's great when individuals can afford to even purchase their next home and move out, and we can do renovations while that's in progress. With Renovation Sells, we do have options for financing available that people can learn more about that do help with that and provide funds to help balance that all out so that you can get those renovations done, make the most of your sale, and be ready to move on for your next big adventure.
What do you think, what are the like maybe two or three most common things that people renovate before they list their home?
Paint is often a big thing. Yeah. Painting in general can be make a huge difference in the home. One of my favorite things to update is light fixtures, because I think light fixtures just make a huge impact in a room and completely change the feel of it overall. Countertops are pretty standard. The most common thing today that everybody's looking for is quartz countertops. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much all we ever put into a home, because those are the most common things that everybody loves, and they want that great looking kitchen.
Mm-hmm. I think like light fixtures doesn't sound like a very expensive thing to upgrade either.
No, and it doesn't have to be. Like, that's kind of what's neat about it. There's so many cool light fixtures out there. It's easy to go online shopping and pick out something kind of unique and different that's going to really provide some style and a little flair in the room.
And just putting some light bulbs in helps, right?
Yes, light bulbs are always a good option.
I was in a house the other day where in several of the rooms there were not light bulbs, and it was dark. It's kind of hard to look around when there's no light bulbs. Okay, so we want to take some phone calls. You're welcome to give us a call. The number here at the studio is 608-256-2001. Give us a ring. We'll take your questions and we'll keep talking until people call. We want to hear from you. Let's talk about something that came up this last week, Heidi. In fact, an influencer here in Madison was talking about how hard it is to get a loan if you're self-employed. In this particular case, this person and their partner were both self-employed and had really good CPAs. So when you have a really good CPA and you're self-employed, income is reported a little differently. And so now I come to get a loan and I'm like, what do we do?
Yes. So there are a couple different options. Most often the option that the lender is going to talk to you about is a conventional loan. And they want to see your past 2 years of tax returns, and they want to see exactly that bottom number. How much did you make? When you have a great CPA who does a really good job at making sure that they are getting all the deductions for you that they can, it means that that bottom number really gets small. And so when a lender is looking at that and they are calculating how much then you can afford, it can really drop your number. And so actually I've been helping someone out right now. They are a local self-employed person and had a very, very small number at the bottom of the tax returns. And I said, you know what? Bank statement loan may be just the thing for you. It's when we collect, you know, 12 months or 24 months of your most recent bank statements. We can send it into the underwriter and they can go through and they can say, okay, these are the deductions we can take out. These are what we can leave in. And we went from just having her tax returns and making about $2,000 of qualified income a month.
Oh boy.
To over $5,000 of qualified income a month. When you start looking at how much that means with purchase price, that mm-hmm. is a huge difference.
Right.
So being able to talk with different lenders and ask them about their products and make sure that they are explaining exactly what the breakdown is. If you do not understand the answer that they give you, ask again. Find other lenders, find other resources. Make sure that you can understand what they're talking about, but also make sure you understand at a base level the product that they are talking to you about.
It would be really easy to get frustrated and walk away from the whole process after talking to just one lender who told you no or gave you a teeny tiny number. And I think what Heidi's saying and what we've all experienced is, you know, interview other lenders. It's, you know, the lender, the realtor, the inspector, they work for you. So interview other providers and see if somebody can help you come up with a better solution. We have some calls. Let's hear what we have.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Hi. I'm just wondering, are there any city or state programs that would help someone with a lower income to be able to afford buying a house?
That's an excellent question. So we lost volume just a little bit. So the question was, are there programs that can help someone lower income with purchasing a home?
Yes. So they are called down payment assistance programs. That's kind of the well-known name. They can also sometimes cover things like other closing costs as well. And so a lot of them are out there in the community themselves. There are some national programs that are funded all year round. Most of the more local down payment assistance funds, though, however, they are not always self-funded mm-hmm. as much as they would like to be. And so they can sometimes run out of money. So if you think that may be an option mm-hmm. for you, I want you to make sure that you are talking to a lender and a realtor earlier in the year. Find out what you can qualify for and how much you can afford. But it is logistically, it is taking out a second loan or a grant that can sometimes, depending on the situation and depending on the down payment assistance fund, that may be able to be forgiven. If you so sometimes it's if you stay in the home for, you know, 5 or 10 years, it may be forgiven.
There's a lot of programs like this, and sometimes we can help our clients qualify for more than one program. I have a client right now that has 2 down payment assistance grants. So if you're working with a well-versed lender, they can help you navigate this. There are local programs, county programs, and statewide programs.
Wow.
Thanks for calling. Did we answer your question?
Thank you. Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Sounds like we have another call.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. I had another lending call. A client of mine recently, about 4 or 5 months ago, was getting certified and getting verified and everything. But their lender was saying to avoid the VA loans. They weren't that good. They would end up... They're saying a lot of negative things about VA loans. And I happen to have had other clients that have VA loans that love them, that saved them lots of money. And I was just wondering what the deal was, why anybody would do that.
Well, lucky for you, Heidi's an expert at VA loans, also a veteran. So I'm going to let her tell you briefly why VA loans are awesome. Thanks for your question.
Thanks. I love a good VA loan. They are probably one of my favorite products to work on. I think they get a bad rap because sometimes they have gone downhill. And so realtors or previous borrowers have said, oh, I had a terrible experience. And we all know how word of mouth works, right? As soon as something negative comes out, it's spreading like wildfire. So a part of my job is actually talking to maybe the list agent or talking to the borrower and saying, hey, listen, I know that you've not maybe heard great things. Here is how I go through the process. Here is how I'm going to help you through it. Here are the things that we can allow on a VA home loan, and here are things we cannot allow on a VA home loan. I think a lot of it just comes down to they worked with a bad lender who did not do VA loans well, and it has created an environment where people talk really poorly about them. But I love them. With a VA home loan, you can actually go up to 100% loan to value of the house. So let's say you are buying a house for $250,000, you do not have to bring a down payment if you do not want to.
That's excellent. That's a hard type of loan to qualify for outside of being a VA loan.
Yes.
Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you, caller. Do you have anything else to add?
Well, the other thing that I've said to people is, you know, they've come, again, people get very stressed out thinking about buying or selling. But when people are looking at selling, there's so much to do. And I've said, find a realtor that has a list of people, like your group there, that help you with it, can help you with anything, that you're not left on your own to get your own mover if you have no idea who or something like that. So, you know, I don't know if you have lists that you give people of help of vendors that you've worked with, but I tell people all the time, find realtors that have vendors they've worked with. It cuts your time in half.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. Any realtor worth their salt has a big list of vendors that they trust and can refer you to. Specific to our topic tonight, the queer and trans community. The five of us all identify within the community or are strongly allied, and we do our best to work with other providers who are the same. And we think it's really important to be able to provide a safe path home for our friends in the community. And you bring a great point up. You know, if you need a resource in town, even if you're not buying a house, call a realtor. They probably know someone.
And they've been vetted to be a safe person.
Yeah, yeah.
To have in your house.
Yeah.
Right.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Yeah. And kind of to that point also, Adam, this is a topic we've talked about before. Like, how do I know that the guys working on the project are safe to come into my house and that I don't have to worry about it?
Yeah, right. I mean, it's something that can be very unnerving to people, you know, inviting somebody into your home. And so that's what I try to specialize in, of course, is I'm hiring subcontractors to do work in people's homes. And so I'm constantly looking for people that I can trust and that I have relationships with over time and that I know will be good. So I have worked in a number of houses for the LGBTQ community. And so I kind of know who's more comfortable, you know, and knows how to handle an LGBTQ person's home, and, you know, and can be respectful in that environment. But
yeah.
But you just want to be, you want to do your homework, right? When you're selecting somebody. So you don't just want to do the first Google search and pull up whoever comes to the top there.
Triple A renovation.
Right. again, talk to realtors, because realtors always know people to call, always have a lengthy list of people. Do your research. Within our community, we have great resources like Our Lives magazine or places like that where you can look for companies that are advertising there, right? And that are allies to the community that are going to be beneficial for you.
Yeah, that's a great call out for sure. Let's talk about some of the things that come up in our community that are unique. Bex, we had a conversation a while ago about folks who are transitioning and how the name change versus the ID might be an issue. Do you want to talk about that for a second?
Yeah, and it's funny because we've talked about it several times, and every time I say, like, I don't know the answers, and I still don't know the answers, but I wish I could. One of the things that does come up is in relation to that financial score that insurance carriers do to get a premium for everybody. Depending on where one is in the transition, like where they're at, whether they've changed their name or their gender marker versus what it might be in motor vehicle registration or in another register that they look at or on their credit reports, they can come up as kind of a no hit. And people that come up as a no hit, they're still getting insured, but they're gonna be offered a higher premium because of that. So, you know, it's obviously I'm not going to be a person that says, hey, this is the timeline that you should do your transition, but it is something that I'm aware of now. And so when that does happen and I do get a no financial hit, I can, you know, I often say, like, this might be a reason. Please now check with your credit bureaus and see if everything is aligning to your social security number. And that way we might be able to lower your score. So that's just one example. I think probably with all of us, it's just the comfort of being able to tell your story. Yeah. Because whether you're on an inspection or getting insurance or talking to a realtor, or talking to your lender, you're talking about sensitive details. You're talking about your life, and you need to be able to talk about your life, be it LGBTQ plus, whether you're in a poly relationship, all of those things do come into play.
Yeah, and you want to feel that you can trust the person you're talking to, and you want to feel heard. And that, I think, goes for all of us, right? But some sensitivities in our community that we need to be aware of. I think we have another call. Hello, caller.
Hi. So I'm listening to your program. I'm thinking about maybe two things. And one is a question. And the other one is an experience.
Great.
So I come from another country, and the idea that I had about lenders and realtors and insurance people was all that they were all there out to get you. So you should never trust them. So based on that, when I was going to buy my house, I didn't trust my realtor when he was suggesting that I use a specific lender. And then I had a horrible experience with the lender that I used. So, it's a question, but it comes from experience. So, like, how important it is to listen to that, to the advice that the realtor is giving you. And also, how do you work as realtors and lenders and insurance agents to maybe go against these uninformed ideas?
Yeah.
That people come with.
That's a good question. I think there's definitely just like a societal distrust for folks in our profession sometimes, and I think we earn trust and then rely on referrals from people that you know and that you trust. So that's part of it. Also, I think, you know, one of the things that I do with my clients is I'll say, here's the lender that I like, but here's two others, or here's three lenders that I like. Here's a couple of home inspectors. You know, just because I like the person doesn't mean that you will, or that you will jive with that person well. So I want to give folks options. And I think it's important to talk to more than one lender because, listen, you're about to spend more money on a house than you'll spend on anything else in your lifetime. So let's get it right. But you make a good point. I think, you know, if sometimes there's a language barrier and folks are afraid that they're not going to understand what's going on. And in that case, man, let me help you find someone who speaks your language so that you can connect in the right way. I think if you find one person on the team of a real estate transaction who you trust, they can lead you to resources along the way. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, if I could add one more thing to that conversation too, I think the sweet spot when you're getting support, especially in the real estate community and the real estate professional community, is I look for people that provide that have a ton of information. They can provide concise information to me without telling me what to do. They're offering options. They're offering insight. And it's sort of this guided educational conversation where they still trust me to make the final decision. And so I think if you find yourself in a situation where you're just like being steered hard by whatever professional you're working with, as opposed to giving really great informed options, that might be a bit of a red flag of like, maybe this isn't the right fit. And I find it's most helpful in, from most professions if they approach it in a way of like, here, I want to give you all the information and help you make the best decision possible for you.
Yeah, I agree with that too. When I'm trying to talk with clients about things like budgets and building trust with them, right, so that they know that they can trust me and I'm not trying to take advantage of them, I think, you know, I will often ask a client, you know, well, what's your budget on this project? And it's not because I'm trying to come in and go, well, I want to get every penny that I can out of this. It's that I got to know what I'm working with to try to help them achieve what they want to achieve, right? And what are the trade-offs in the process?
Yeah.
And when I'm looking at a home that sells, it's the reason why I want to work with a realtor and the homeowner before a home is going to get listed, because I want a realtor to look at a property and say, okay, if we were to list this home today, we'd list it at $500,000. But there are comps that are showing 575. So then great, we have two numbers there, and then the question is, okay, can we put $25,000 into this property to get it up to that 575 mark? You know, and using options, you know, and thinking about the ways that you get there, and building trust that way with clients.
Yeah, I say this often, real estate transactions are a team sport, and I work for you, the buyer or the seller, and I want you to be happy with the end result. You know, when you're selling your home, my objective is to get you the most money that we can in the best offer. If we get 10 offers on a home listed, we might not take the offer that has the highest price tag on it. We're going to take the best offer. And so my objective is to always work on behalf of the client and get the best result at the end. So, you know, we all know that there are unscrupulous vendors out there in every profession. And I'm sorry that you got involved with a lender that it didn't go well. But it's just a matter of interviewing more people, and don't work with one that you don't feel good about. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling. Okay, I think we have another caller.
Yeah, I just had a quick question again. When you're needing to do credit repair, should you be working with your lender and your realtor to help you with that, or should you go with the people that say they do that on, like, advertisements, you know?
So I'm going to give you a preliminary answer on this, and Heidi's definitely going to chime in. So sometimes people say to me, I don't know if I'm ready to buy a house. And I don't always know what that means, why they don't feel ready. But sometimes it's because they're worried that they have a low credit score or they don't have enough money saved. And so the conversation then becomes, well, let's sit down and talk about what you might be looking for and make a plan to get you ready, right? And often that will include a lender in that conversation. But Heidi, what do you think about... She has opinions. You can see it on her face. What do you think about credit repair?
There are many different avenues to credit repair in whatever aspect that you're looking in. One of the first things that I'm going to ask if it is okay to do is I'm going to ask you if it is okay if I pull a credit report. Not everyone is okay with that. That is completely fine. I, however, really like hard data in front of me. That makes it so much easier when I'm creating a game plan as to, okay, we are going to pay down, maybe we want to pay down a credit card because we are trying to change the debt to income ratio. Or maybe it is paying off a certain installment loan, or maybe it's just getting one installment loan so that it's under 10 months of being paid off, because then I, as the lender, under most lending programs, can just omit that. So it's automatically taken out of your debt to income ratio. So I really like the hard data from the credit report so that I can give the best guidance and information of how to go about repairing that credit. And there are some times where you, as the consumer, can go ahead and do it on your own and you don't need to pay an agency. There are some times, though, where if I think it's needed, I may say, hey, listen, here's a couple different credit repair agencies. I want you to work with them. or between the three of us, I want us to work together and we are going to fix this so that we can move on to purchasing a home. But there's a good amount of time where I can just give you a few pointers and you can do it on your own.
Yeah. Sometimes it takes time and we're patient and you're patient and we get to the end result that we want when we get there.
Yes.
You know, someone might have a 2-year plan to get the debt paid off and get their credit score up before they can get a good rate on a home purchase. So sometimes it just might be a matter of making a plan.
Yes. And you yourself have access to pull your credit report once a year for free. It is a bylaw that you are able to do this. So make sure that you're looking for those resources where maybe if you are not in a place where you want to talk to a lender, you can always go and pull your credit report by yourself and look over it. And if you start seeing things that concern you, you know, maybe start talking to a professional.
Right. That's good advice. Thanks for your call. Okay, let's tell some stories. We all have some really good stories. First of all, our friend Sam lives in a tiny home.
That's the story we're going with?
Yep, that's what we're starting with. Go ahead. Tell us, you live in a tiny home.
I do.
With your wife and...
Four children. And a dog. It's 311 square feet, and yes, it's too small. It's
what
a temporary situation.
You?
Well, we knew we were going to move. We were living in the Milwaukee metro area, which is a great spot. No shade against Milwaukee, but with our four kids and both of us being from the middle of, kind of grew up in the middle of nowhere, we wanted to have a little more room out in the country and not room in a home, obviously. So I bought a burnt down mobile home trailer and cleared it and cut down the size of it and built a home on it. And it's on wheels. I wouldn't move it regularly. It's very large and the wheels aren't great, but it did move. And that's my current living situation. We are building a normal house this year. And tiny houses are great. It's really cool.
Yes.
In a lot of different ways. But with a family of six, you know, we're at 50 square foot per person if you give the dog 11 square feet.
That feels generous for the dog. So. Yeah, that's awesome. We want to hear more about that sometime. Let's do a whole show about tiny houses.
Sure, we can do it. Maybe we could get someone else in that just lives like one or two people in a tiny house and they could share their perspective. And, you know, maybe they have like a flushable toilet instead of a composting toilet. You know, there's all sorts of stories we can get into.
Okay, that's a good one.
I actually want to hear about how the composting toilet kind of interacts with the rest of the tiny home and you guys. How do you feel about that?
It's simple, actually. You have to make sure that the ventilation's set up right, and then you basically have to change it out every... You basically have to carry out any liquid or solid waste. With a family of six, liquid waste is every other day at the minimum, and then solid would be, you know, it's probably every 2-3 weeks. And it basically, you put like...
When you say carry out, sorry, is this in your
house? Really get into this.
Wait, we'll send you pictures.
No, it's really not as... I mean, it's not great, but it's not terrible. There's like a container, a diverter that separates liquids.
Google composting toilet for images.
And you go pour that. Actually, in parts of Europe, there are entire fields where they kind of like dose out separated liquids from waste treatment plants to make the treatment much faster. And then you have to find a safe composting place that's secured from animals or whatever because you don't want to make sure it's composting safely.
Yeah.
And you just leave. And there's like a... coconut fibers, or there's all sorts of like kind of mulches or whatever you can buy that kind of mix in with it. And then there's a crank handle you turn every time you use the bathroom.
Bex, we'll give you Sam's number and you guys can talk about
we can
more
talk
detail.
More off air.
I think might need to take him out for some coffee.
There you go.
We'll talk about it.
Now we want to tell Adam's got a really good story. We talk about, you know, Safe Path Home and making sure that folks in the queer and trans community feel safe and welcomed. And there's things that we do in our homes as a community or to our homes as a community to just make sure people know they feel safe. You have a great story about this I want you to tell.
Yeah. So last year, about this time, we learned that our neighbors were going to be putting their house up for sale. And I instantly got a little anxious about who might be moving in next door to us. And I had joked to my husband, I said, as soon as showing starts, we're going to put our pride flag out. And about a month later, I did that. And he was like, oh, you were serious about that. And I was like, yeah, I was serious about that. So yeah, we put our pride flag out for the whole time that their showings were going on. And their house sold, the new people moved in, and about a month down the road or so, we were talking with them. And the couple who moved in next door to us turned out to be a biracial couple. And they said, yeah, as we were looking at houses, we saw your flag and we felt more comfortable about buying this particular home. So that was a real win for us, and we feel really, really happy about that overall.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of anxiety in general about, oh, the neighbor we know is moving. Mm-hmm. Shoot, what's going to happen next? No matter who you are, extra anxiety if you identify in the queer community, for sure. And so putting the pride flag out is definitely a good move, hopefully.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did it hoping to kind of ward off any evil spirits, and it worked.
Right on.
Can you actually talk about what a realtor can do when helping people find the best neighborhood for them?
Yes. So licensing law for realtors prohibits me from saying, this is a great neighborhood, this is a bad neighborhood. I can provide resources to people to help them identify places that are more desirable to live. We can talk about school districts. We can look at tax bases and things like that. But legally, realtors are not allowed to steer you into any specific neighborhood. It's called steering, and it's against licensing law. I do the best I can to help folks find resources. Here in Madison, the Outreach Community Center is a fantastic resource. They have a housing team who is happy to help as a resource for things like that. I mean, there are other resources in town as well to help navigate those things. Truthfully, drive up and down the street and look for stickers and flags. I was with a client on Sunday at an open house, and as I was driving away, I texted them that there was a pride sticker on the truck next door. I mean, that might seem like a small thing, but it's not. It's huge. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a huge sign.
When I was telling somebody else that story, they said, oh, so you were staking your claim, right? You were saying, like, we're here. And it's true. I mean, that was part of it. Like, we're here and you're going to be living next door to us. And that's that. So it certainly helps.
Right. What else should we talk about? Bex, was there a story you wanted to tell? I
always have them, but right now I don't, because you asked me if I had a story.
Yeah. So now you don't. You know, you alluded to this, and maybe you and Heidi can talk about this. How is the home buying experience different for couples or, you know, polyamorous families who aren't married? I mean, the difference between lending to a couple who's legally married and lending to a couple who isn't?
Well, on the lending side, by law, you cannot be discriminated against whether you are married or not. That mm-hmm. is a huge red flag if you maybe feel it or see it or experience it. As far as lending, some lenders will only allow so many people on a mortgage. Sometimes it's 4. And so a lot of the times I will see this where maybe there is a younger couple and one of their parents are helping them out with it. And so there ends up being like 4 people on a loan. And they are relying on the parents' bigger credit history and right. maybe a larger income to help offset some of that. When you're looking at a couple as a whole, sometimes it may be more advantageous for me to leave someone off of the mortgage itself, but we still have them on the title. And I'm actually dealing with this right now with one of my buyers. But that also means that my communication with both of them, that they are very clear Like, when I'm communicating with you, I'm communicating with both of you because you are a couple and because this is going to impact both of your financial
future.
Your financial future. And so I want to make sure that both of them understand, here are the payments, here's how it's broken down, here are the different things that we're looking at when we are creating this loan. Again, because both of them are going to be, you know, financially tied to this piece, to this land. So a lot of times, even though somebody may not be on the mortgage, I'm still including them. I'm still making sure that they understand what is going on. Mm-hmm. And that they have an understanding of this. This is something that I actually experienced myself when we were purchasing a home. We had only been together for a short amount of time when we bought a home. And so my partner actually bought it with just their income and just their credit, just because we figured, okay, if we do end up splitting up, it's going to be okay because they can still afford it on their own and I will just move out. Mm-hmm. And I felt really disconnected through the experience with the lender and the realtor because they would never talk to me. And that really felt kind of off-putting to me. So I always make sure, especially when I'm dealing with couples, whether you are married or not, that we have that conversation of, do you want to be a part of the financial decision-making? Can, you know, the person as the borrower, you know, are you okay with me talking in front of your partner about your finances mm-hmm. and about the payments and everything else? So it is something to be very aware of.
Yeah. And so legally, if two people are coming to the table to buy a home together, married or not, they can purchase the home together, they can be on the mortgage, they can be on the title. On paper, it's a joint effort.
Correct, yes. Yeah. And there are some loan programs who will allow me to add another person on the deed or on the title itself, however, not on the mortgage. Mm-hmm. However, that also being said, there are some loan programs who will not allow anyone to be on the title if they are not on the mortgage. So that is also something to be aware of as well.
So it's important to communicate with the lender and the realtor what your intentions are from the start so that we Correct. Can help you find the solution that makes the most sense for your situation.
Yes.
Right? So communication's super critical through the process.
Yes. And it is one thing that I rely on heavily. If you are not hearing from your lender at least once a week, if not more, that's usually a red flag. Mm-hmm. Even if it's just a quick text message of, hey, everything's going smoothly, we right. are in this point in the process, they should at least still be talking to you about it.
Mm-hmm. And your realtors and your lenders should be talking to each other.
Oh, sometimes I talk to the realtors more than I actually talk to the buyers.
Yeah, same. I have that situation as well. Yep. So we have just a couple minutes left. Okay. Any final words from, how about everyone, just one final comment? What can we do to make this experience great for everyone?
I would say buying a home is incredibly worthwhile. And if you are scared, but you're considering it, it's not for everyone, but it is in our country, it is the closest, easiest pathway to building wealth for you and your family and your children. And I think it's a really great endeavor. So I would just encourage you, if you're scared, if you feel like you're far from it, maybe you are, but if you talk to the right people, they'll give you a pathway and support you and walk you through it. So like Vicky said, it's a team, and start building your team whenever you really start to get that feeling.
Yeah, that's a great piece of advice. Do you have more advice? Adam, Bex, Heidi. Sam's
right. You did such a good job.
I know, I know.
That was so perfect.
Yeah. I was just going to say, it's just all about, yeah, finding those right people. And there's good people out there to support you in the process. And you just have to.
I find that most people who are like afraid of owning a home, it's more that they just don't have the right amount of information, right? And so just call someone and say, hey, can we talk? I'm not going to try to get you to buy a house. Let's buy coffee.
Education is important.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone, so much. This has been so much fun. We cannot wait to do it again. We appreciate you joining us here on the Access Hour tonight.
Thanks for all the callers calling in.
Yes, thank you, callers.
Thank you.
You were so awesome.
You've been listening to The Access Hour. The Access Hour is WORT's commitment to community access to the airwaves. For this hour, we have turned the airwaves over to a member of the public. The views expressed on The Access Hour do not represent the views of the station, its staff, programmers, or the board of directors. Remember, though, that this show relies on your ideas. An application to produce a program can be found on the internet at wortfm.org. Look on the left side for Sign Up to Host an Access Hour. Music, talk, comedy, drama, or whatever can be conveyed over the radio, the Access Hour is anything you want it to be.
You've been listening to WORT, Back Porch Broadcasting, Madison.
Game of the 2024 Madison Roller Derby season is on Saturday, April 6th in the arena at the Alliant Energy Center. This month's matchups are Reservoir Dolls versus Unholy Rollers and Vixens versus Quad Squad. Doors at 5 p.m., skates hit the track at 6 p.m. Tickets can be purchased online at madisonrollerderby.org/tickets or at the door. The final home game of the 2024 Madison Roller Derby season is on Saturday, April 6th in the arena at the Alliant Energy Center in Madison. Supporting community nonprofits since 1975, this is WORT 89.9 FM Madison, listener-sponsored community radio.
It's a real thing, the things I hold in me. It's a real face, the peace and I. When the rain bends, it takes me to nowhere. When the wind grows and the beetles cry. My mind.